The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening space show. I'm your host, David Livingston. Great to be here, as always. And thank you all for joining in. We're going to have a most interesting show tonight, a subject we haven't really addressed very much, only in passing over the last nearly 12 years of the space show. So this is a unique and sort of a first-time discussion and program. And I'll introduce our guest in just a minute. But first of all, if you want to call the program, and I think you will, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners. Do let the phone ring, and we'll bring it up on air as quickly as possible. You can also send us short emails at drspace@thespaceshow.com, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And remember also that we do allow you to copy these shows, pass them around, share them, send them, however you choose to do that. A 90-minute show is roughly 40 gigabytes, so keep that in mind. The only things we ask of you is not to do anything commercial, no edits or commercial cuts on YouTube or private websites or anything like that. And also we don't permit written transcripts. And do remember that they are trademarked and copyrighted shows. But again, you do have the permission to distribute them and share them, and we hope that you do that. And then we do podcast with gigadial.net. Excuse me, and Andrew helps us out with that. And you can find our RSS URLs to subscribe to our podcast on both of our newsletters and our website. If you do have any questions about our podcasting, let me hear from you at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We're in iTunes, Podcast Alley, astrospacenow.com, yastro.com, Zoom, and most all smartphones work really nicely with Space Show Podcast off of iTunes or one of the other services, or you can listen to the archive shows right off of the Space Show website. Again, if you have any questions or issues, please do email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com, which is our website. And on thespaceshow.com, you'll find the comprehensive newsletter, which is uploaded Sunday evening. It has all of the details of the week's program, the guest bios, and it's the only place you'll find a future events section for the Space Show. Everything we do is archived, and it goes back to 2001, so you can easily listen right off of our site or also easily download the shows. There is a Space Show store. You'll see it up near the top. And then again, there is a Support the Space Show button there. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we exist because many of you do support us, and we're deeply appreciative of that. Your support keeps us on the air. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you do get a federal tax deduction since we're a nonprofit. And if you're a California taxpayer, you also get a state of California deduction. And if you have any questions about any of this, visit OneGiantLeapFoundation.org or send me an email at drspace@thespaceshow.com and ask away. And that brings me to our guest tonight, and I'm very happy to introduce to all of you the Pillow Astronaut. And this is Heather, let's see if I can do her last name right, Arculeta. Did I get it right?
Very close.
Very close. She is a fellow San Franciscan, except that she was actually born here, and I'm an Okie by birth. She has her degrees from nearby Mills College over in the East Bay in Oakland, University of London in England, and she has worked for large tech corporations such as Western Digital and Oracle, but she also went to work for NASA in their program for flight simulations, and she has been involved for several years in studies regarding the long-term effects of weightlessness on the human bodies, and her projects have helped JSC scientists learn a lot more about how to keep astronauts healthy in space for long-duration flights, and she now works to find other qualified applicants for these ongoing programs. And she is referred to as the Pillow Astronaut. She has a blog, http://pillownaut, one word, pillownaut.blogspot.com. And her blog describes the flight simulations in both personal and medical detail. She's been featured on Wired, Popular Science, Fox News America, as well as outlets in Europe, India, Scandinavia, and Russia. She also has a website with lots and lots of pictures on it at pillownaut, pillownaut.com. Heather, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm great. How are you?
Fine. You're not going to go to sleep on us during our interview, are you?
No, God, I hope not. No, that's actually probably one of the bigger myths. You don't sleep. You're in bed, but you don't sleep.
You don't sleep at all, or do you get some sleep?
Well, yeah, no, actually, you don't sleep during the day. One of the things that Fox News has been wonderful about getting the word out for us, but one of the things they do that still kind of drives me nutty after all these years, they still tend to put it on television as a sleep study. But, no, it's lights out at 10 p.m., and you're woken up in the quarantine facility with music, just like they do for the astronauts on the space station.
What do you mean in quarantine? You're in quarantine doing these studies?
Oh, sure, yeah, the bed rest studies. They have a special facility on Galveston Island, which is where I went for two different ones, and it's a locked ward. Partly for medical privacy and partly because one of the side effects of long-term bed rest can be immunosuppression. Your immune system can actually lower. That actually happens to astronauts on the space station as well. So they don't let people come to work sick, and not everybody can just walk in like it's a hospital. You have to have a reason to be there.
Are you the only one on the ward, or do they have multiple people at the same time you're in there?
Oh, actually, there is room for six men at a time and four women at a time. So there's 10 potential spaces at what they call the FAP, or Flight Analog Program Ward, which is at UTMB, the University of Texas Medical Branch Hospital on Galveston Island.
Are you in private rooms, or are you in a big ward room altogether?
I was quite lucky. The two times that I was there, they didn't really have a full ward of women. They almost always have more men than women at any given time. I had a room to myself for the two long-term studies that I did there. But each room is designed for two people to be in it at a time.
So when you say long-term, what are we talking about?
Well, the shortest study I did was, I think, 24 days, and the longest study I did was over 70, and they have one that's over 100.
So are you literally in bed the entire time, or can you get up and walk around? Can you walk to the bathroom? Can you watch TV? I mean, what's this really like?
Well, you're walking around when you get there. For about the first week or so, they get you used to their diet and the amount of water consumption that you have to consume every day, because it's very precise based on your height and weight. They see if you can acclimate to that before they put you in bed. But after about a week, you go on a slanted bed, tilted back 6 degrees, and then you're there for whatever the duration is. In my case, one time it was 14 days head down, and another time it was 54 days head down. And no, you can't get up to go to the bathroom. You're on bedpans. They have a special shower facility where they transfer you over to a mesh kind of gurney so that you can shower with nozzles that are within your reach in a private room. But no, for as long as they want to study you, for as long as you're simulating actual spaceflight, you are head down the whole time, and you can't even get up on your elbows.
Do they drug you? Or how do they get you to do this?
That actually would have been fun. No, because they take so much of your blood and your analysis and things like that, you've got to be very clean. In fact, there's not even any caffeine. So, no drugs. I think the strongest thing I had while I was there was an aspirin about the third day of simulation. You do go through the same stages of space sickness as people do in weightlessness, and I had kind of a little back pain, a little headache pain, so they allowed me to take some aspirin, but that was about it.
So, seriously, how do you stand it? I mean, even a short 24 days, I guess that's short. How can you tolerate it?
Well, I wondered that myself sometimes. I won't lie. I had a couple of episodes where I thought, my God, what have I gotten myself into? But I could set my mind at rest. I had some trustworthy people watching my house and my things back home.
Uh-huh.
I can do my job with a laptop, so I worked part of the time. I found the bottom of my email inbox for the first time in a decade. So a lot of the times it was great. You have an incredible amount of free time after you're done with your tests for the day. Every bed has a little spring board over it with a laptop so you can see it above you. Every bed has its own television. And then there's a common room where we would all go watch movies together. A couple of people brought guitars and other musical instruments. I learned sign language while I was there. Other people have learned, I've seen them learn Japanese and Russian.
All while laying down, 6 degrees down?
All while laying 6 degrees head down. Yeah, we even did paper mache. And, you know, I mean, you're doing everything head down. You're brushing your hair head down. You're eating three meals a day head down. You're showering head down. So you'd be amazed. The body adapts very quickly to just about anything you can throw at it. Adaptation later, getting up, was actually harder than staying in bed. Twice a day they have you do stretches, and that's just to combat thrombosis. Every other day you get a massage from a professional, so that part was fantastic. Everybody looks forward to that.
So when you go to watch TV, they carry you in on a slant board, and you're all watching TV that way together?
No, actually, the beds roll.
Oh, the beds roll.
Yeah, they'll just take the break off the beds, or they'll row you to a gurney and put you on a bed that's already out there.
So you had movies and sports events and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah. And there were some people that there was a video game console, and I guess you can bring your own if you like. You can bring your own laptop, or they'll provide you with one. If you want your privacy, they'll wheel a television into your room if you're the only one that wants to watch it, for instance. There's a lot of things to do. And everybody, while they're there, paints a ceiling tile. I'm not sure how that tradition got started, but if you walk into the ward and look up, there's dozens and dozens of painted ceiling tiles with numbers on them, because, of course, our names are confidential in many cases unless we make ourselves publicly known. So for a while, you're a number, and everybody gets a little art project. So over the time that you're there, you'll spend time painting your personal ceiling tile so that you can leave your mark behind.
Do you get graded on how well you did, or were you a good subject or something like that?
Yeah. Your sign that you're a good subject is that you get to stay. If you're a bad subject, you're tossed out pretty quickly. I actually did see that happen.
Do you get the results of the study?
No, I have heard that we will see them with everybody else when they're published in certain journals. We certainly are privy to our own medical information. I saw my screening binder, and I saw a couple of my like ECG and EKG tests and other blood tests and things like that. But no, I don't know any larger results yet.
And I guess they're giving you a special diet, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, the diet is very, very specific. In fact, people go to my blog and then click on my photo galleries, I photographed most of the food.
Is it tolerable?
It was in there. It was wonderful. I thought it was great. The only thing I missed was salt. I'm a heavy salter. And you can't have any salt. Sugar's pretty low. Carbs are pretty low. It's a diet pretty high in protein. And it's very specific. I had mornings where I got, you know, like a pancake and a half a single scrambled egg, 4 ounces of orange juice with liquid iron, and, you know, based, they weigh you every single day on this giant industrial scale. They put you on a little canvas and lift you. And then, of course, their goal is to try to keep you at exactly the same weight throughout your entire program. So all of your foods and liquids are measured very specifically, and it's all very healthy food. I found it pretty palatable. We got pizza and burgers sometimes, but more often it was things like chicken and fish and vegetables.
So this is not where you go to lose weight then, because they want to keep your weight up.
I actually did lose weight. That's their goal. But I actually came out, I think, about 4 pounds lighter than when I had went in on one test.
So in the qualifications to do this, do you have to be, can you be on any medicines? Can you take, like, Lipitor or blood pressure medicines? Can you be 60 years old? I mean, what are some of the parameters?
Living in Texas is a good one. They're all very interested in Texans or folks in the Southwest because, of course, it's easier for you to get there. You can't be on any regular medication. I know disqualifications are things like high blood pressure or any kind of heart trouble because, of course, if you have a condition, they certainly, you know, they don't want to aggravate it. Some of the testing is pretty intense. A couple of times I had to literally bicycle to exhaustion.
Laying down, you had to bicycle to exhaustion?
No. Before you go to bed, there are certain types of tests that they do to see what your limits are in terms of exertion, cardiovascular function, physical fitness, functional aerobic capacity, isokinetic, your muscle strength, and things like that. They test all that before you go head down, because they want to be able to test it again later and see what effect spaceflight had on your body. And they expect you to degrade slightly. You know, almost everybody loses a little bit of bone density, and, of course, your muscles tighten up a little bit. And, like the first time I got up, my feet were very tender because, of course, I hadn't used them for almost 2 months. Just stepping on them was a little bit painful.
So do your muscles atrophy and stuff like they do in space? Is it a really good simulation or an approximate simulation?
Well, having not been to space, I can only tell you the conversations that I've had with the astronauts that I've met and who knew that I did these studies, and I would ask them to, you know, compare what did you feel. And from what I understand and from the data that they get, they've been doing these for, you know, they've been doing these tests since about 1960, and they're going to be doing them for at least up through 2020, I think. They're fairly accurate. Almost everything that they experience in space, we experienced in bed, right down to the good and the bad. Feelings of, you even get a feeling of weightlessness when you're adapting. But unfortunately, that can also turn into dizziness. They want to make sure that you're not a sleepwalker. You shouldn't be prone to vertigo, standing. I think kidney stones is another something that can rule you out. They do an Air Force Class 3 physical as part of Phase 1. The testing goes through 3 phases. It's definitely not for sissies. You're gonna find out what you're made of from this, absolutely.
Do you do a physical for each phase?
The way I did it was they do very basic stuff. You show up and they get your height, weight, temperature, blood pressure. They do an initial ECG. I had blood draws for things like tuberculosis, HIV. They'll do a normal blood panel. And if your CBC comes back and you're clear of steroids or leukemia or anything basic, then you go to phase 2, which is auditory and vision tests. You don't have to have perfect hearing. You don't have to have perfect eyesight. Again, this is one of those things that they might test as a baseline, and then they'll test it again when you come out of bed to see if there are any changes. But the physical exam is kind of the same thing you'd get from an ears, nose, and throat doctor. Then joints, muscles, heart. I had a neurological exam for reflexes, acuity. I had to do some balance tests. I had to prove I could balance on each leg. They do a DEXA scan, which is very important. I know one of the things they really, really concentrate on is bone density, mostly of the spine and the hips. And then you get a couple of full electrocardiograms.
What about anything mental? Do they try to determine if you're stable or a whack job?
Yes. Yes. Whack job will definitely rule you out. There's a written psychological questionnaire. There's a computer-based multiple-choice psych screening. In phase two, you have live psych interviews with counselors, and they do a program for just, like, support tools and how to cope, and they'll question you pretty closely, particularly about what you plan to do with your time. I think if you do think it's a sleep study and you apply there saying, yeah, I'd love to lie around in bed all day, they would probably turn you away. What they want to know is that you'll put the time to good use, that you're very interested in the space science, that you want to add to this body of data, that it's going to be very important for space station studies. It's going to be important for us in terms of going to Mars and going on longer and longer duration space missions. They'll want to know what you know about those things and why you're there. So, yeah, the psychological component is very important.
Is there an age requirement?
There is an age requirement, yes. You can screen at as early as 24, but you have to be 25 to be invited into a study, and I believe the cutoff age is 55 for men and whenever you reach menopause for women.
Interesting. So why? Well, I'll ask the question this way because a listener asked you, and this is from Brian in Denver, Colorado, and Brian says, Heather, what would make you want to go through this?
What would make me want to go through this?
Yes, and his last line is they can't possibly pay you very much to warrant taking all this crap.
No, that's true. Yes, the pay was definitely lower than what I did for a living, I guess you could say. It works out to about $160 a day and about $5,000 a month. So, yeah, you definitely don't do it for the pay unless maybe if you're between jobs, it's something that you could look into. But no, I did it because I desperately want to see humanity reach Mars in my lifetime. I want to see that. I want to see that broadcast. And I think these studies are incredibly important in getting us to that point. It's only one component of, you know, I think we have much larger problems. We have the propulsion problem. We have the radiation problem. But bones and muscles and keeping the primate in the capsule healthy to the, you know, almost 2 years that it's going to take us to get back and forth to the red planet is significant. And I did it because I think it needs to be done. I think humanity needs to take this step onto another celestial body out there in the solar system, and every bit of data helps us get there, how we respond in isolation, how each person's bone density responds, whether you're male, female, of a particular race, whether you're 25, whether you're 45, all of these things need to be documented so that we can learn to develop countermeasures of life in weightlessness. Without gravity, very, very specific things happen to the body that have to be counteracted. Because even if we get a person to Mars, that person has to be healthy enough to get out of the ship and go conduct science experiments on the surface. They have to be able to be healthy enough to collect rocks. We've got to find a way for them not to fall into depression in a ship on a year without being able to see blue sky or trees or eat normal food. All of these things are things that we need answers to these questions if we're going to get there.
Here's a question for you from Jerry in Des Moines, Iowa. And listeners, come on, this is a nighttime show. You can pick up and use the phone. Nobody's, at work, like you do on Monday and Friday morning. 1-866-687-7223. So Jerry in Des Moines says, given what you know about the subject and your own experiences, and I'm assuming you realize that going to Mars with humans is not going to be a cakewalk on many levels, what is your reaction when you come across space advocates or people promoting humans to Mars in 4 or 5 years, one-way trips, even Elon Musk saying he's going to put 60,000 to 80,000 people on Mars really soon. Does your hair curl? Do you take it in stride? Do you believe all of this stuff? Or does your wisdom and experience tell you that there's a screw loose someplace?
Well, no, I wouldn't accuse anybody of having a screw loose. I think the intentions are fantastic. I love the enthusiasm in any form, whether it comes from Elon Musk and a fast timetable or, researchers saying that they're tackling a certain problem. I think it's all good news. I think as long as it stays in our consciousness and stays as one of our goals, I think that's a good thing. I guess I could answer that by saying I'm a little bit skeptical when I hear about very fast timelines because, yes, I do, you know, I think I do have a grasp of the propulsion technologies and the radiation issues. I think those are probably the top two things that make it not a cakewalk, to use his words. But I also don't think we should discount some very famous astronauts saying, you know, if it takes a one-way trip to get the colony started, let's just do it. And there are some who have already come out publicly and said, if I have to die on Mars, I'll die on Mars. Send me. There's, you know, if every time I go to an industry conference or a space up or even just a meeting of others, you know, space enthusiasts who really believe in going to Mars, if anybody gets up and asks the question, who here would go to Mars on a one-way trip, you'll see more than half the room raise their hand.
No, I know. There's a lot of, I mean, I don't know if they would really do it when they got ready to sign on the bottom line and be disclosed. But
yeah. Maybe if they saw what the screening is like and what the, well, and I can only say this. I've gone through screening similar to what astronauts go through, but I have not gone through the training.
Right.
That astronauts go through. So I've seen what they have to do to get into the astronaut corps. But once you're there, my gosh, it only gets harder. And, of course, there's that joke about, you know, what is an astronaut? He's someone who trains for 6 years to go into space for 8 days.
Well, I was fortunate enough in this summer to go inside Endeavour when they were readying it for its tomb over at the Los Angeles Science Museum.
Yeah, how exciting.
And a lot of the gear was taken out of it. But the pilot and co-pilot seat were still there. And of course, it was horizontal. It wasn't vertical as it is when it's on a launch pad. But most of the galley equipment was gone, and the seats in the upper level were gone. And I don't really think that I'm claustrophobic unless I'm in a CT scan or an MRI scan, and then I'm, you know, drug me, please.
Yeah,
and,
close your eyes.
But I have to tell you, being in the space shuttle for any length of time with seven people, there's zero privacy.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you're going to go use the head, there's zero privacy.
It's very kind of, you're going to use the head in front of everyone.
I mean, I would have a really hard time, you know, functioning for a couple of weeks, even in the space of a space shuttle. So I can't imagine what it would be like, you know, on a long-term mission going to Mars, even if you had twice that or three times that amount of space. And so in your bed rest studies, are you, you know, even if you're in a double room and you're alone, is it large? Is it like a hospital room? I mean,
yeah,
you know.
there's quite a bit of space. Yeah, there's no simulation of tight spaces.
Okay, that's not there.
A shuttle flight deck, yeah.
Okay, so another thing I talk about on a lot of shows, because it's important to me in terms of settlement or long term, as weird and as stupid as it sounds, is that if I'm going to go live on another planet or Mars or something, and assuming that the technology is there to, you know, support life, and you're just not going to go there and arrive dead or emaciated and die shortly, I would really want to take my pets with me. I would want my dog with me. I can imagine you can't have dogs or your cats come into your bed rest study room, probably, right? But is there any talk about, on especially on the psychological side, about having animals with you or to be part of whatever the trip is? I think that's an absolutely natural thing that humans do.
I would agree. Having been involved with pet therapy and owned animals at different times in life myself, I would say that's very important. Unfortunately, I think that would be cost prohibitive, just the sheer amount of money it takes to put anything in space, anything at all. Any ship that went there, if it needed a hydroponics module and if they needed self-sustaining food and medical equipment, I think animals would probably be pretty far down on the priority list, because it would just be one more biological package to keep alive. Although I do think anything that went to Mars, you would probably still have a contingent of experimental animals. I think they'd probably have those water bears, those little things that they say can live in the vacuum of space. They might take those out and see how they do against radiation. There'd probably be mice or crickets or tadpoles, and to see what happens with the development. But, you know, there's a lot of ethical questions involved in that as well, because humans can make the decision. And even if you get halfway to Mars and say, oh, dear God, what have I done? Because you will have that moment. A dog can't make that decision. A cat can't make that decision.
Well, we consider our dogs, I guess, and cats as property.
Yes.
So consent is not typically an issue outside of humans, unless you're doing an animal study, and then of course that study is replete with all sorts of requirements to protect the animal.
Yeah, but that doesn't keep people from. I know there's a lot of people that protest NASA's use of monkeys, and all the way back to Laika, the first dog that died in space. Russia took a real beating over that one, because they did not even design a way for the dog to come home.
Well, they protest animals in medical studies all across the board, so having a son that has benefited from that, to hell with all the protesters, that's what I say.
Well, that's another one that I don't know, though.
And I, you find nobody around who loves animals more than me, probably more than humans. But you can't be visited by anybody or your pet or anything during the studies. All of that is kept sterile and clean, right?
Yeah. Now, I don't recall seeing any pets. We did have pet fish. We were allowed to have fish in little bowls.
Fish?
Yeah. Some of us had Siamese fighting fish by our bedsides, and you'd feed them every day and you know, watch them swim around. That was considered relaxing. That was a nice thing.
So who would you get someone in the staff to change their water and stuff like that, since you couldn't do it? You couldn't get up to do it?
Yeah, they would. There's a lot of stuff that's done for you because you can't get up. So, yeah, every other week or so, they'd go clean out the fishbowl and bring us some food.
Well, then, could you bring a canary or a parakeet in a cage?
That I don't know. I don't know if anybody even asked. I don't think so, though. I think a bird cage would probably take up too much room.
And they might, you know, spread seed and flower and feathers and stuff all over the place.
Yeah, that might actually have some airborne issues with it. And they want as clean a data as possible.
Another email. What's wrong with you people? You ought to pick up the darn phone. 866-687-7223. So here's a long-lost friend of mine that I'm hearing from after ages and ages and ages. And I'm assuming, John Carter McKnight, you got your PhD and you are off you go. And are you still in Phoenix? John Carter McKnight, I'd like to ask the opposite of the previous question. How do you make the case to skeptics that going to space is worthwhile? What do you find makes a difference in people's opinions and impressions? Fabulous question, John. Thank you.
That is a really fabulous question. I run up against this all the time. In fact, I would say one of the biggest problems that I've run into when I was first on the news and people were first finding my blog and emailing me things were mythology. People that thought the government was killing me.
You're not kidding us?
No. You should see some of the emails that I got telling me that it was irresponsible and unethical of me to not only do this to myself, but recommend it to others because eventually I would be crippled. And, you know, even 30 days in bed will age you 30 years and all of these very, very...
Do these people identify where they come from, what planet, what culture?
Yeah, I know. Well, and it's okay. If you don't understand the medical side of it, That's fine. I would tell them, you know, there's pregnant women who spend more than 30 days on bed rest, and even if you have side effects, that's, you know, that's for the health of the baby.
Right.
So in practical terms, while the particular studies that I did are most directly applicable to how microgravity affects the human body in order to create countermeasures, this research can also shed light on how to better care for pregnant women whose babies' lives depend on bed rest, or people with injuries, which leave them no choice but to remain immobile for long periods, like broken spines or, you know, hip damage or things like that. So in a broader sense, the benefits from technology invented for space missions, and this is true all the way back to Mercury, they affect millions of people on Earth every day. Modern firefighters wear suits made of the fabric invented for use in spacesuits. Helmet padding protects the heads of NFL football players that was developed by NASA for air, you know, for aircraft seats. You wouldn't have a cell telephone if it wasn't for NASA. You wouldn't have satellite TV.
Why? I thought it was Star Trek that gave me the cell phone.
That's right. That's right. They gave you the flip.
I've been flipped.
No, I'm not saying NASA invented the cell phone. They invented the technology that makes it possible. Satellites don't get into orbit by magic. And the laundry list of things, whether it was the law of unintended consequences or something that someone was trying to invent deliberately, from smoke and radiation detection devices to virtual reality simulators, cordless tools, heart pump implants, micro lasers. If you've even had an MRI, that's space technology. Joysticks on a video game, that was the space program. Water filtration, lightning protection systems, crop dusting accuracy systems, weather forecasting and forewarning, oil spill cleanup technologies. It's all around us every single day, and that's a constant kind of hurdle trying to get people to understand the daily applications, that it really isn't just about going out into space and having fun because we've never been somewhere before.
Well, do you reach people when you get on the soapbox and do this, or are they still blowing you off and being highly critical?
Sometimes I have, actually. I've been on forums where I've had people say things about the bed rest study, and I'm always very gentle and I'm always very kind. I try not to get too soapboxy. Maybe that's why I've had some success in saying I can speak to this because I've done it. And you really can't argue with that. I've done it, and I'm healthy. I run 5 miles three times a week.
Oh.
And I've done, not only did I, you know, I had somebody ask me in my very first radio interview, would you ever do it again? And I can say yes, looking back now. I did 3 of them, and I'm perfectly healthy. But I was perfectly healthy going in, and that's important, because if you're not healthy, they're not gonna mess with your body. So sometimes, yeah, if you bring it down to the level of Earth. Let's not even talk about space. Let's talk about what it does for Earth right now. And that is, if you're having a heart attack, do you want an ambulance to find you with a paper map or with a GPS system?
It depends on who it is who's having a heart attack.
Well, you, your mom, me, anyone. Do you want them to, you know, use the most cutting-edge thing that space has provided us with while someone's life is on the line? Or, you know, do you think that... Well, of course, you know, one of the battle cries is, why are we spending so much time in space when we've got all these problems here on Earth? Space simply is solving a lot of the problems.
No, absolutely. Earth. I mean, we know that in our community. It's
sure. Yeah,
harder to make it. You know, I have, you know, without saying too much, but I've mentioned many, many times on the show that I have a son with CF, cystic fibrosis. So part of the side effects of this raunchy genetic illness as you get older are bone density issues and stress fractures, especially in the spine.
Sure.
So this is starting to occur occasionally, you know, with my son. They're very painful, and he has DEXA scans all the time, and this is because CF creates malnutrition in the body. So the reasons for it are different in space, but the outcome is very, very similar. So when I get involved and talk to the doctors, I find that I'm really on par with them because I know the issues for astronauts and for space and the kinds of things that you're talking about. And I can reference some of the studies that NASA has done on bisphosphonates and other uses to try to deal with these issues. And it really makes a difference in care and treatment and the response of doctors. So, you know, I hate to say this, but I really think the more informed you are and the more educated you are and the more you are unwilling just to accept whatever they say as the gospel, but you know what you're talking about when you engage them, the better treatment you get. And I don't think that's fair, and I'm not advocating that by any means whatsoever, but I've noticed it for the past 28 years. But space and microgravity and bone density issues and stress fracture issues have had a direct application to the medical care cystic fibrosis people get when they have bone density and stress fracture issues.
Absolutely. I think you'll find that a lot of people with osteoarthritis and osteoporosis would say very
same
much
thing.
The same thing.
Early onset osteoporosis, very, very similar to what is different reasons, but very, very similar outcomes and treatments and protocols coming out of the SPACE program.
Sure. Oh, and I've had a couple of people ask me, you know, if you had healthy bone mineral content and you have strong bone density, why would you put it at risk? And you know, because I'm one of the lucky ones, because I'm one of those people who has natural, rock-hard bones, and they weren't able to degrade mine.
Did they recover? Did they degrade and stay degraded? Or did you recover what you lost?
I had almost no degradation.
Wow.
And so I think that's why I was able to do 3 studies in 3 years. So it was just natural. And this is one of those things that even though we're not really privy to study results, we're only privy to our own T-scores and things like that. And, of course, I've actually had a DEXA and a PQCT since I've gotten out of the studies as well, and I see that it's holding fine. If you're one of those folks that has it strong and you can risk it, you're a good study. They're studying, you know, the mechanism that keeps it strong. And while I was discussing that with other subjects, you know, we don't know the results, but we actually discovered amongst ourselves things that probably were not a coincidence. And it's one of the reasons why we made good study subjects. For instance, none of us had ever in our entire lives broken a bone.
Not even a finger or a toe.
Nothing. Nothing at all. I've never broken a bone. I've never had surgery. I've never been on medication. And that was true for quite a few folks in there. We all had naturally low blood pressure. And this, you know, I started thinking, I thought, gosh, you know, that's got to be what they look for in astronauts, too. You know, wouldn't that make sense? People that have never broken bones, well, you're probably, you know, got pretty strong bones to begin with then. If you've never broken one, and I've been in, I don't know, 3 or 4 car accidents. I was about 5 years old. Most people have. Most people have fallen out of a tree or...
Or they have a sports accident or something.
Yeah, gotten knocked down playing soccer. Sure, you know, lots of stuff like that.
So not even a broken rib, nothing.
No, not a single one of the people that I was in there with. And after a while, I actually kind of started asking. You know, because we would talk about our medical results. We would... The culture of the ward while you're there kind of becomes very intense. I mean, for example, a bunch of these people I still keep in touch with on Facebook. I mean, this the first study I did was in 2008, and these are folks that I still talk to from time to time. You know what everybody's day is. You know, oh, what's your day? Oh, I'm on day 30. Oh, he's on day 50. Oh, so-and-so just hit their halfway point. And so, you know, we have a little celebration because somebody made it halfway. There's a little celebration when somebody finishes. You know, you bond because you're going through a really unique experience. And you did a lot to be there. You know, the screening process is incredible. They get thousands of applications. And really only the top incredibly healthy people who are mentally prepared to undergo this procedure will make it in there.
Paula in San Diego has another email. I guess it's going to be an email night. Paula is wanting to know, can you tell us if there is any significant difference, if you found out among race, gender, and age? Do you have any details like that?
The youngest, I can only tell you what I saw, and I can't give names, of course, but what I witnessed, the youngest person I met was 25, right at the cutoff. I believe the oldest person the first time there was me. I was in my late 30s at the time. I'm 43 now, so that would have been 38 when I did the first one. The other folks there were late 20s, mid-30s. I met two African-American men, one African-American woman, three Caucasian men the first time, one other Caucasian woman, although unfortunately she had to go home in the middle. I don't believe she finished. I'd heard of two other folks that had washed out, Caucasian. One of them sat up. I guess he just kind of started to get a little stir-crazy. But I don't know to what degree there's any statistic about, you know, depending on race, gender, age, who does well and who doesn't. From what I saw, everybody really wanted to do well. And in my personal experience, everybody who was there finished, except for that one study where we were evacuated because Hurricane Ike was headed straight for Galveston Island.
We'll do this question, and it's my question.
Okay.
And then we'll take our break. But you mentioned earlier that they probably would be doing these studies at least through 2020. Why are they still doing them if they've done so many of them and so many people have gone through it? Are they continuing to learn more because the sample size keeps getting bigger? I mean, why do they continue doing it?
Well, partially because they really do need, you know, more of a cross-section. They find it pretty tough to get women. They need women of all ages. They need men of all ages. They need all different races. And just doing the, it's a slow process, you know. There's only 10 beds, so you can, even when the ward is full like it is now, you can do just so much with the staff that you've got. I also think a big part of it is that each study has very different components. I did a microgravity study where I was head down. I did a lunar gravity where I was tilted upward to simulate the 6% gravity of the moon. So that was interesting. They do compression garment studies. There's one going on right now where you are tested before and after, and then you go on bed rest with particular garments that I guess they're testing to see if it would be a good material for spacesuits. There's a couple of different exercises that are measuring testosterone fluctuation, so of course that one's just designed for men, and they are still looking for men for that one. There's one in the Cleveland Clinic up near NASA Glenn in Ohio, and there's one at Galveston where they are using a vertical treadmill, and it's identical to the treadmill that was designed to be on the International Space Station. You've heard of the Colbert?
Correct.
Yeah, and they're using that to compare against a control group. You know, they'll put a bunch of people head down, and then they'll have one group use the treadmill and weight resistance, and they'll have one group not, things like that. So every year they kind of go through different studies, and the protocols might change. They've also started using smart pills. That wasn't part of my program, but it came afterward.
Smart pillows?
Smart pills, P-I-L-L-S.
What's a smart pill?
It's something that you swallow it, and it goes through the body, taking certain kinds of measurements that sends data back to the scientists.
Oh, okay.
And actually, I do have, if folks are interested in going to my blog, about halfway down, there's a little block on there. It's a journal from a fantastic friend of mine named Scott Saslow. He did a microgravity study that had a smart pill component, and he kept a daily journal, which I published. So he and I worked together to kind of bring that up, because you know, of course, my blog is largely the female experience, and I really wanted to have somebody willing to give the detailed experience of what males go through in there too. So that's a fantastic read if you're a guy and you're thinking of doing these studies. And the good news is you won't have to take a pregnancy test every 3 weeks. Like I did.
Why would you have to take a pregnancy test every 3 weeks? I guess to find out if you're pregnant and it's starting to show up, right?
Yeah, actually, that was just during screening. Obviously, you're not going to have sex while you're there because you have no privacy whatsoever. You're monitored continuously.
Whoa. You're literally, you're monitored. You have zero privacy?
You have zero privacy.
Except when you do your shower, you talked about. Or...
Yes, you're in a private room for the shower, and you have a curtain you can pull when you urinate or defecate, but everything else is, there's monitors that, they kind of have to be around you because you need things handed to you. You know, you need your toothbrush at a certain couple of times a day, and they have to bring you your pitchers of water, and if you want to put your laptop aside and read a book for an hour, you really do. You need someone there to help you all day long.
So you push the button all the time then for help, right?
I'm sorry?
You push the button all the time for help, right?
A lot of times they're right on they're at the doorway.
Are they pretty nice, or do they get their patients worn thin? Or
oh no, they're wonderful. In fact, I think they're probably screened similarly to how we are, you know, because their goal is to keep you happy, keep you calm, make sure that you are busy and that you don't get bored, and you know they'll go around and try to get you interested in crafts. And
so, are they nurses, or more like a nurse's aide or a candy striper?
They're like candy stripers, monitors, yeah. But they are educated on all the protocols. They know exactly what you can and can't do. And they're wonderful. The ones that I had monitoring me were great. They're like, you know, would you like to go outside for 20 minutes today and get some fresh air? And they're very conscientious of the protocol. Like, you're not supposed to have any direct sunlight. So they have to pick a route to wheel you where you'll stay in the shade.
So they wheel the bed and
things like that, yeah.
Amazing. Let's go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, and that becomes a lot more important than you think. Just going outside and seeing a tree can make your whole day. You know?
Did you regret it at any time during the studies?
Yeah, they stuck a needle in my foot once, and I regret
it. Oh, shit.
Yeah. A couple of the medical tests are a bit challenging, and they do a dorsal hand vein test where they do certain countermeasures with different types of substances to see what effect it has on your blood pressure. So they do dorsal hand and dorsal foot. Those are a little bit challenging, and it's kind of hard to stay still. That was the one day that I went, oh, wow, please don't do that to me again.
And they don't numb your skin before they do it?
No, huh? No.
Wow.
Got to try to stay as still as possible. There's also a tilt test. You probably heard about that. That's where they do ECG on a swivel table.
Uh-huh.
And then they test you ambulatory, recumbent, and then they kind of smack you upwards and see what effect it has. And they've had people, you know, vomit for that one. I was glad that I didn't. But, yeah, you get a lot of blood draws. There are some definitely invasive tests, and there are also tests where you go to exertion. Pretty good exertion. Most of it's pretty easy and painless, though. You have nutritional assessments. What else you have? You have neurological assessments, what they call posturography. That was a great team. They were fantastic. You do balance tests, and then you see if your balance changes over time, depending on how long you've been weightless. They have different measurements of the immune system and plasma volume measurement with tubes to see how your blood reacts throughout the body over time, because it will get a little less. You get a little puffy in the face. You ever see those films on the space station?
Yeah, of course.
Sure, you know, where the astronauts look like their faces have gotten rounder because all the blood is kind of shifted up to their head. Because without gravity, you know, you don't need it in your feet. And that same thing happens on bed rest. You get that kind of puffy stuff, and the brain kind of reads that as, oh, I don't need as much blood, so it stops making as much of it, and you'll see physical changes with that over time. So they definitely keep you busy, but you do have quite a lot of free time. I guess that's the upside. Somebody does your laundry for you. Somebody brings you three meals a day. It's probably the most relaxation I've gotten in years, and I'm real type A. I'm real active, moving around all the time, sometimes having two jobs at once and doing charity work or riding or whatever. So it was actually nice. You get to slow down in a way that you don't normally in life, you know? It's an interesting kind of break from normal life.
Okay, but bottom line is, you know, and then we'll take the break, I promise.
a break. Okay.
The bottom line to me is that If you're really kind of an uptight, modest person about privacy, using the bathroom, different things like that, you're going to have a real tough time in space, and you're going to have a real tough time in one of these studies.
Yes, this is not for you.
I mean,
you have to do this because you want them to have your data, because you want that data to be clean and that you're making an effort to contribute something to the space program.
Yeah, so being shy and humble and all of that is just not. I've interviewed Mike Melville and other astronauts who have written the books, and they are very clear at saying, look, if you, you know, can't deal with the bathroom with seven people around and this,
right,
this, and this, you don't even think about it, because there's just no privacy, no humbleness, nothing.
That's exactly
you're
it.
Just bare clean to everybody there all the time.
Sure, and it's, you know, don't think it's not a difficult adjustment. It is, because, you know, our culture is very private with certain things that have to do with our bodies. But when you're in an environment where they're studying your body deliberately, you just have to prepare yourself for those basic facts. And from what I saw, everybody was very adult about it, but there are certain things that are going to happen. Almost everybody spills a bedpan at one point. Almost everybody vomits at one test or another, or experiences space sickness to the point where they're cranky and they don't want to talk to anybody. Those things happen. Those are human things, and they're going to happen in space too.
Okay, now we're going to take a break, and listeners will come back in 3 minutes with Heather, and use the phone instead of the email, okay, because it's a lot more fun when you call in. 1-866-687-7223. My audience really doesn't like the telephone. It's very frustrating.
No, of course. Well, we're all science geeks. We like to type.
They want to do chat and text message, all this garbage.
Yeah, I do the same thing. No, I'd admit it. If I called into the show, I wouldn't call. I'd email myself, so I understand.
But real quick, do you know if Russia and China does anything like this, or ESA?
You've heard of the Mars 500?
Yeah, and there was just an article about it today that was not very positive about it today.
No, yeah, I guess they're looking at some of the data of the things that they learned about isolation and so forth, but that doesn't make it any less useful.
Correct, yes.
Isolation and immunosuppression and psychological criteria for how to choose a crew and bed rest were all a big part of that study, and that was a joint effort between ESA, Roscosmos, and the Chinese Federation Space Program. So they're all doing very similar programs.
Okay.
And actually, there's one right now in Europe, in Toulouse. In fact, someone just contacted me to tell me that he was a subject in the new bed rest study that they're doing in three phases for the European Space Program, and they did an article about it, and they used the word pillow knot, which absolutely blew my brains out. So they're calling their European Space Agency subjects pillow knots now, too, which I thought was so funny.
Did you trademark it?
No, I've never trademarked anything. I was tickled. I thought it was great. The more people that know about it, the better.
Stand by, everybody, and Heather and I will be back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, We will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And good hello again, everybody. We're in part two of our Tuesday Space Show. We're talking about NASA simulation studies, specifically bed rest studies, with Heather, who has done them and who also recruits for them. During the break, Heather, you mentioned that there's actually one individual who started all of this. Tell us about the founding of this, of these studies.
Oh, okay. Well, the founder is considered to be Dwayne Graveline, and he was an early astronaut candidate. He was also the chief flight surgeon in the U.S. Air Force in the late 1950s, and he worked in aerospace medical research, also at Wright-Patterson and what they called the School of Aerospace Medicine at the time, and he was very interested in deconditioning, I guess is probably the word they used for it then, but it was the idea that if and when we go to space, what would weightlessness do to our bodies? I think he was probably the first person to kind of really think about that and how we could have countermeasures to zero-G conditioning, because at that time, I mean, we had no idea what was going to happen if we put people in space. He was the one who first suggested, I think, the position of bed rest and water immersion in order to look at how the changes in the body might happen if gravity was not a factor. And if we were just left floating to our own devices, what would happen to our blood, what would happen to our bones and muscles and things like that. But I believe the military at the time also did some studies. When I first started looking into the program and trying to, you know, figure out did I want to do this or not, and I started kind of looking on the web to see what was available. I didn't find a whole lot, but what I did find was from the 1960s. If there are any earlier than that, I'd love to know about it if anybody finds anything earlier. Because I think the very first ones I found were in 60, 62, and 66.
Okay, and I'm assuming Dwayne is no longer with us, correct?
No, I believe he's still around.
Oh, he is still
Dwayne
around.
Dwayne Graveline, he's still alive. Mm-hmm. He writes books now. In fact, he does, you'll see him pop up in a space article every now and then. He did a number of publications about fluid distribution, diuresis, physiological effects of hypodynamics. He worked in water immersion for quite a while in the 60s. But then later on, he worked with the Soviets as well, doing bioastronautics over there.
He might be an excellent guest on the space show.
You know, if you had a way to hunt him down, I'll throw you his last website that I did a blog post on him a little while ago. I'll send you that.
Yeah, I'll try to hunt him down. And I know a lot of people who are members of the Aerospace Medical Association, so he may be a member and his vitals are listed there for contact.
I'm sure, yeah. It's there. I'm looking at the profile. I'm always on my computer, pardon me. His wiki page says that he's 81 now.
Well, he could still be coherent and able to do a show.
Oh, I'm sure he is.
How do you spell his last name?
Graveline. And he's got a lovely little picture here with a lunar module. I love it.
Well, if I hunt him down and get him on the show, you want to co-host it with me?
That would be awesome. I'd drive the Tiburon for that.
Have you ever met him?
I have never met him. I hope at some point maybe one of his assistants or kids or something has Googled him and maybe found my blog post about him.
Okay.
No, I've never tried to...
If I find him and he's willing to do it, I'll coordinate it and have you co-host it, because you can ask a lot more sophisticated questions than I can. And you have your first caller finally instead of an emailer.
Oh, how wonderful. All right.
Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John in Atlanta.
Hi, John. How are you?
Well, pretty good.
Do
we have any information when we compare the bed rest studies to actual, let's say, space shuttle or space station? A space station would be ISS would be more appropriate. How good of a simulation that is, of weightless environments?
Yes. That's one of the reasons why I think after a while they changed the name to be an analog program. For every astronaut that goes up there, you know, they're going to want to compare that data to an analog on the ground. Hopefully they'll find somebody of the, you know, same gender, same height, same size, same timing. And most of the data that they collect on the space station, I'm sure, is compared to what's on the ground, and that's how they make the protocols more specific with every study that's tested. I remember at one point asking the principal investigator about certain symptoms. This is Dr. Renita Cromwell, and she's the head guru for the bed rest studies at Johnson Space Center. Absolutely fantastically brilliant lady. And anytime I got a chance to talk to her, I would always tell her, you know, what I was feeling and is this normal and do you hear this from astronauts? And so it was a great conversations. I learned a lot about what they go through, and I wish that they talked about it more, you know, what they go through day to day. And a lot of times they also develop the ground protocols based on what astronauts tell them when they come home. I've also had conversations with two astronauts, you know, kind of telling them what I went through, you know, and using examples like, well, how long did it take you to drive a car after you got home from space? And he said, oh, you know, it took me about 2 weeks. How long did it take you to drive a car after you got up from bed rest? And I said, well, women's vestibular systems are different. We tend to have a little bit harder time balancing, so it took me about 3 weeks.
Whoa, it took you 3 weeks when you finished to be able to drive again?
Oh, yeah. My depth perception was all off. In fact, I bounced into a couple of walls. I had people asking me if I was trying to get to Hogwarts.
Did you walk out of there on your own power, or do they wheel you out? How do you leave?
They wheel you out, yeah.
In a wheelchair.
Yeah. Well, getting up can be a slow affair. Well, you've seen them come home, you know, from Russia when the capsule bounces down and they have to carry them out.
Yeah, they carry them. Right.
Yeah, the same's true for us. The first day, they just kind of help you sit up. And they monitor your blood pressure very carefully.
So you don't go home immediately. They keep you there.
Oh, no. No, you've got a rehab period, certainly.
Under their care.
Yeah. Just getting up takes a day. Yeah.
So how long would you stay there for rehab?
2 weeks.
Well, so you're there for 100 days for the study plus 2 weeks to rehab?
No, that's all in the...
So that's all in
all the... self-contained, yeah. It's a week of testing beforehand, then you do the bed rest phase, then you have... you know, stages of getting up, sitting up, standing, wheelchair, walking, and someone's always holding you up. Then for a little while, you've got to kind of take it easy again, because as soon as you use your muscles, of course, they're going to be very achy because you haven't walked on your legs and feet for a long time.
Can you start lifting weights or anything like that?
Yeah, They had physical fitness coaches there to help us do certain types of exercises to get us back walking, and so, you know, you have stairs one day, which, you know, seems impossible at first, but then, you know, you readapt, you know, and from what I've spoken to with a couple of different astronauts who've been on the space station for 3 months each, we had a lot of the same symptoms, a lot of the same aches and pains. I was lucky, though. I don't do stuff. Like, one of them told me, he said the hardest thing for me to get used to when I came home was that I kept dropping stuff. I forgot that stuff didn't float. Whereas, you know, here in the analog studies, we are still subject to gravity in many ways. If you drop something off the bed, you just have to chase somebody down to pick it up.
Yeah. John, what else for you, please?
Well, okay, so... one thing is there a big problem with like bed sores and stuff with this? Because unlike in space, you know, where there really is no gravity or any significant gravity, on Earth there still is gravity even though you're in bed rest. So.
Mm-hmm. No, the only kind of minor problem that I had was an ingrown hair on my leg, and I just had somebody pluck it. Certainly when you are lying down for a long time, that's a worry, but that would mostly be, I would think, for people who aren't conscious. or for people whose immune systems are very compromised, like the elderly, if they're bedridden. We are allowed to move. You have to get on your side to eat, because swallowing would be almost impossible while you're head down on your back. So they've got folks there who will teach you, you know, get up, put one elbow out, move your fork this way. You can turn as often as you like. You can even turn over on your stomach and hold a book below you if you want to read. Every other day, we would have a massage. Every single day, twice a day, we would do stretching exercises for our neck, back, arms, and legs. So there is actually quite a movement, and they really do encourage you to move your arms quite a bit, because that's how space station astronauts propel themselves. So the bigger problems over time usually occur in the spine, hips, and feet, but most astronauts come home with perfectly healthy arms because they do use them a lot. So we were also encouraged to use our arms as much as we could.
How do you keep from getting bored?
Oh, gosh, I was never bored, but I'm very active on the Internet. You can see I started a blog thinking that, you know, maybe my mom would read it and think, you know, just know that NASA wasn't hurting me. But
she didn't read it, did she?
Oh, cool. Yeah, she did.
Oh, she did?
I hope my family did. But then when it was on TV, it really exploded. So I kept a daily log. I kept a daily calendar. As I said, I was learning sign language. There was a lot of folks there that we would watch films together and have conversations about things that we were going through. On some days, testing really does take a lot of time. It can take hours. So you would be around the scientists quite a bit. And I was... I asked them just about every question in the world I could think of. If you've got a captive audience of a bunch of NASA doctors and scientists, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. They'd want me to shut up. You know, I'd be nonstop. Even John would be nonstop.
Yeah, exactly. I just, you know, I had them there. So I was like, well, what does this affect? And have you seen this before? And what do astronauts say about that? What happens when you go to Russia and get them out of the capsule? What's your, you know, experience? And it was great.
Hey, John, would you do this? You're a young guy.
I don't know. I mean...
How bad do you want to go to...
I'm kind of a person that likes to move around and stuff, you know, like...
but if you want to go to space someday, wouldn't this be, like, good preparation for going to space?
Yeah, it's good practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Well... I don't know. Another question here. The thing that concerns me here, okay, we're talking about going to, say, Mars, maybe 8 months or so to fly out there. And like you said, it took maybe 2 or 3 weeks to get back where you could drive a car.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when they get there, these guys are supposed to get into some kind of a landing vehicle, like the Mars equivalent to a LEM or something, and safely pilot this thing down to a landing on Mars. And then conduct operations on the Martian surface for a period of time, collecting samples, doing experiments, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a very difficult situation to imagine, if you see my point.
Well, remember, Mars is a lot less gravity than Earth. So
that's true, yeah. It's only 38%.
That would be certainly an aid, yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right, though, because there are other concerns, like we just talked about the vestibular system. Balance and depth perception are very important, and those are compromised. I can say from personal experience, it took me time to get that back and to readjust just to being upright and to walking again. And that didn't come without a certain amount of readjustment and pain. So, you know, that's very significant. And... one of the things I would say is that, going back to David's questions about why the study's been ongoing, and that is that they've got a lot of different components. My study did not consist of any exercise. We were bedridden very specifically to see the effects on muscles and bones, because they were testing pharmaceutical countermeasures and testing our blood pressure to make sure that, you know, they weren't enlarging our hearts or doing anything like that. But there's a lot of studies out there that use vertical locomotion systems to see if there is no degradation. Like on the space station, you know, we've got weight resistance training, we've got a treadmill, we've got a bicycle. All of those and more, I'm sure, would be on any kind of spaceship to Mars. They've experimented over the decades with calcium supplements and different ways of balancing electrolytes. All those kinds of things are going to come into play. And in terms of time, you know, we may not be going to Mars as fast as Elon Musk, but I would say back in 1969, we sent a couple of guys to the moon for 3 days. In 2013, a couple of guys are going to go to the space station for a year. Now, that's a heck of a lot of progress. It may not seem like a lot of progress because we've gotten used to going to space a couple of times a year, and we're all, you know, we're all familiar with it. But if you went back to 1969 and said to somebody, you know, we're going to have folks in space for a year, they might have thought it would happen even faster. You know, but we've gotten there. We've made the steps.
Well, you have the Russian who's been was on Mir for more than a year.
Sure, but I don't know if we knew then what we know now.
Well, I'd be
curious to know what sort of medical shape that he's in.
Well, he was an MD, and that's probably what kept him alive.
Yeah.
And he does have problems to this day that have resulted from his being, I think he was like a year and a half on the mirror.
Yeah, I'm
so if you read about him, and I always forget his name.
I do too. I know exactly who you're talking about.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, he still has issues that came about from all of that. Could they be, you know, circumvented or avoided if he did a year and a half on Mir today? Were Mir still there? I don't know.
Yeah, well, even if Mir had had a treadmill, if they'd known what they know now about, you know, just basic average stretching exercises or calcium or whatever it is they're, you know, doing for different heights and weights, I'm sure it would be different. Back then, there was a very small body of data for that kind of thing.
John, anything else from you?
Well, all I'd say is I've been focused on the idea for some time of pursuing the issue of more from a point of view of a very advanced propulsion to cut the speeds down, the time frames down to get there, than just enduring weightlessness for such an incredible period of time. But I guess it'll be one way or the other.
I hope so, too. I know Franklin Chang Diaz, the ex-astronaut, is working on some very cutting-edge plasma dynamics. I hope that pans out. I hope it's not cost-prohibitive to produce.
Okay, everybody, there is a new... Well, don't you just love these WhiteHouse.gov petitions that everybody's caught on to?
Oh, no.
You know, so there is now a WhiteHouse.gov petition for nuclear thermal propulsion to do both non-human and human spaceflight ASAP.
Huh.
And I signed it tonight, and I got the information from Cosmic Log, Alan Boyle's thing over at MSNBC. So if you go to Cosmic Log, you'll find it. I forget what the name of the petition is, but, you know, if you get, 25,000 signatures, then the president by law has to reply. It doesn't mean the reply is of any substance. It's probably all BS. And, of course, the petitions have no, you know, validity or legal standing. But for those of us that do care about this and would like to see nuclear propulsion and faster transit times, sign the damn petition. And go to cosmiclog.com. It's an MSNBC.com website for science. And check Alan Boyle's work, and you'll find the link to it. You do have to register for WhiteHouse.gov petitions. You can't just sign it anonymously or anything like that. So you have to open an account, which is free, and that means you give the government some vitals about yourself and your email address and a password, and then you can do any and all of the WhiteHouse.gov petitions. And some of them are a lot of fun. And I urge everybody to go out and sign the nuclear propulsion one. I mean, I'm a big believer in nuclear propulsion. So
absolutely, yeah. If we made that trip shorter, a lot of this would be easier.
Would be easier, yeah. John, go sign the petition.
Okay.
I want to get a report from you that you signed it.
Yeah, give us the name of it.
I don't have. Actually, I can give you the name of it. John, do you have anything else while I get the name of it real quick?
I think that'd be it.
Ah, you're not helping me out here, huh?
Oh, you want me to talk about something else?
Yeah, well, I go get the name of the darn petition.
Yeah, I'll try to fill up some time here.
Let me see if I can get if I can't get the name of the petition, I'll forget it. But I don't know that I can get it real quick. So,
I only heard the one about them wanting to build a Starship Enterprise or something like that.
Well, that's
I have a feeling the White House is going to cut those petitions off pretty soon.
I don't think that one's going to get 25,000 votes. I think
no.
It's 25,000. Isn't that the number of signatures you have
something
to have?
Like that. Yeah, you could come up with 25,000 Trekkies, I'm sure.
Here it is, nuclear thermal rocket petition. Okay, and nuclear power in space petition asks White House to rekindle the project. So this is Cosmic Log on NBCNews.com. And what is the date of the article that I'm looking at? By Alan Boyle. Of course, I can't see the date. How terrific. Okay, it's a petition. Of course, it would have a long name, everybody. Petition calling on the White House to build a nuclear rocket for fast interplanetary travel. And then you go to We the People, which is, I guess, their petition site, and it says, we petition the Obama administration to rapidly develop and deploy a nuclear thermal rocket for both manned and unmanned space missions. So it's a long title, but that's how you find it. There are 590 signatures to it, and they need 24,410 more to get a White House response.
Okay. What was that website? I'll put this on my blog tomorrow.
I'll email it to you. How's that?
Okay.
After
awesome.
The show. And,
yeah.
John, I'll be nice and I'll email it to you. And
better.
Listeners, I'll put it in the archive summary. So how about that for service?
Sounds great.
Okay. Now, do you have anything else, John?
I think so.
Or
yeah.
You're kaput for the night?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
Right.
Listeners, our line is available if you want to call in, 1-866-687-7223. And let's see, what else? You recruit people for these studies. So how do you recruit people? I mean, this sounds like a real uphill battle.
Well, most of the time it's I've been experimenting on social media and just putting material out there and seeing if we can find healthy folks who are interested. It helps that I know a lot of people in a lot of communities that are interested in space. The blog has been indexed by multiple search engines, so most of what I get is questions from men and women about my experiences and how well I recovered, and most of them say, you know, well, how can I get in on this? And so I usually just ask them the kind of initial things, well, you know, are you a smoker? Because that's an automatic no. You know, do you have any regular medications, because that's an automatic no. And if you can rule out a couple of the really easy automatic no's and you're the right age, I tend to try to go for people 25 to 55. And then if they have a healthy interest and I think that interest is for the right reason, then I throw them over to the Johnson Space Center website for the Human Test Subject Facility in Houston and I'll let the screeners take it from there.
Do you mostly get contacted by women, by men? Do you find one group more receptive than others?
Actually, it's both. I get emails and stuff on social media from both men and women, probably a little bit more of the men. And I know they are always clamoring for women. It's a lot of the studies, I think they've got so much more data on men than on women. So there's women out there who think that they could do this. It would be great. I also find in the studies, this might just be my own gender bias talking because, of course, I've had more in-depth conversations with the women that I've met there, that they handle the non-privacy part better.
The women do?
Yeah.
Wow.
That well, and I think it's because, you know, we have physical exams all through our lives that are intimate, that men may not experience until middle age. Both of the women that I'd met there also had children. I was the only one that had never had a baby, which is probably unusual by my age. But, you know, in 20s and 30s, when women are having kids, they've been in a hospital environment before. I had never been in a clinical environment before, so I actually turned out to be the anomaly. That they were used to doctors and nurses and things like that. So.
Interesting. I would think it would have been just the opposite. You got another question from John Carter McKnight, and he says, so, Heather, how did you read while you were in bed, and how much? And then he replied about his dissertation comments that I asked him about. He's defending it this semester. Good luck to you. The ethics of spacefaring. You know what, John, that sounds like a great space show, so let me know when you want to do it.
Awesome. Yeah.
Okay, so how did you read? Did you turn over on your stomach? What did you do, and how much, and what did you read? Science fiction? What?
Yeah, that's a careful affair. I'll admit I did drop a couple of books on my face. That's you have to be careful when you read. You have to read at the middle of the day when you're most awake, because when you are in bed all the time, you have to be very careful not to doze off. But that was actually going back to what you were talking about, how do you not get bored? I am a voracious reader, and I read everything, science fiction, history. I like biographies. I read one of Gene Kranz's books while I was in there, in fact. I read about 30 books altogether in that first study, that very, very long one. So that was great. I'm one of those people, you probably like this too, you always have like just a stack of books waiting somewhere. I actually got through almost every book that I'd had in my stack. In fact, I had my brother mail me some more while I was there.
So do they have a library, or do you bring them with you?
They do. They do have a library. I picked a couple of books out of the library, more of the brain candy kind of spy novel kinds of stuff. But you can bring books with you as long as what you bring fits into your, you know, closet. Everybody has their own little space and their own little wardrobe, and you can, whatever fits in a suitcase and stuff like that. I brought a couple of books, quite thick books, on medieval history and the Tudor dynasty that I'd been waiting for a very long time for time to really sit down and read, so I got through both of those.
Is there any censorship? Like, if you brought steamy airport sex novels, do they care about that?
No, I don't think so. I think that's totally up to you. If you wanted to have whatever kind of books or magazines that you like, I think that's okay.
What about movies? Do you bring your own DVDs, or do they have a library, or do they get first-run movies in?
Every single one of those, yeah. You can get stuff on your Netflix account. I think they just have cable television there. I don't remember any pay channels, but there's a VCR, and there's videos. There's a DVD player. There's a activities coordinator who will go out and rent movies for you. So that was actually one of the really nice things. It was this very nice young lady, and she would bring in lecturers to talk to us. She brought in some people from the United Space Alliance. She would go to Blockbuster. She would go to the post office and get stamps for us. If you needed toothpaste or shampoo at, you know, Walgreens, she would run out and shop for you and bring stuff back.
So you had a personal shopper.
Yeah, yeah. And when I needed to mail stuff home, you know, they gave us NASA T-shirts one time, and so I I snail mailed those back to my family. She took the box to the post office for me, and so that was kind of cool. And books and videos are just kind of everywhere. I brought a bunch of DVDs with me, and you can also get mail there. So while I was there, I ordered some stuff on Amazon, and I just had it sent to NASA, just had it sent to the Galveston facility. So.
And so you could get it right there?
Sure, yeah. Any kind of, you know, and other people ordered video games and books and stuff. You know, Amazon was great for that kind of thing. We'd just sit around, and when you've got free time and you're done with your work for the day, or you're done with the scientist testing you, and, you know, you've got a lot of play time. It's actually fantastic. I know maybe a lot of people think that sounds boring, but to me, if I had a full day right now just to read a thick book and watch a movie, I'd love it. I'd do it again.
Eileen in Seattle says, if you happen to be a very religious person and you go to church on Sunday and you're observant, can you participate in such a study, assuming everything else checks out?
Absolutely. In fact, they've got chaplain services there. Part of the orientation binder that I got was asking about religious denomination and if you required any kind of services, so absolutely. The only problem I would foresee is that the diet is not negotiable. You absolutely must eat what they set in front of you because it's measured very carefully for your height and weight every single day based on what you weighed that morning. So if you absolutely had to have a kosher diet or you could not eat foods for particularly spiritual reasons, that would probably be a disqualifier because you have to keep to the nutritional and liquid protocols there.
Was it vegetarian or did they serve meat?
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah, I had chicken, fish, beef burgers. If you're a vegetarian, that might also be a bit of a sticking point because you will get a little bit of pepperoni on pizzas. A couple of the breakfasts had sausage. I'm trying to think if we ever had bacon. If we did, it was seldom, but I think we did.
Here's another question. Can you stay a few more minutes?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
Sally's in Portland, Oregon. Most laptops today come with a webcam. Would you be able to set up a blog or something and stream pictures of yourself doing the study, or would that be considered a no-no?
Oh, sure. I don't see why not. If you go to my blog and then click on the photo galleries and go down to the ward pictures, I have photos of myself in bed, in testing, in screening, for the next study. I've got pictures of us painting our ceiling tiles, doing paper mache, pictures of us in bed with our little pet fish. I don't see why not.
Well, here's a personal question from Jock, who is in Salt Lake City, and he says, are the bed rest study participants catheterized, or are you able to freely use whatever the facilities are in bed, or did you have to be catheterized?
No, I didn't see anybody who's catheterized. The women, we have wide bed pans, because, of course, when we urinate, it's got to go below us. Men can use that if they like, but more often they have one of those little plastic tubes with a handle.
Uh-huh.
And you'd be amazed. After a while, you really do kind of lose your shyness. I had a couple of guys just put that under the covers right while we were talking or watching a movie, so, you know. You might think it's a big deal, but it becomes less and less important. Because, and I think astronauts would tell you this too, you have to do it every single day, 2 and 3 times a day, so before you go to bed. So you lose your fear about it. your shyness in some cases.
Well, this is why they need young people, because the older you get, the more resistant you're going to be to.
A little more set, yeah.
I would think so. What have I forgotten to ask you about or you think we should know about?
Oh, my goodness. To tell you the truth, the range of questions that you had and that all of your emailers and callers have had have been fantastic. I can't think of anything that I went through that I would say, oh, you need to know this. We've covered a lot. A lot of this stuff I wouldn't have even thought I remembered.
Oh, you got another one that just came in. Randy in Tucson, Arizona.
Really rolling.
And he says, okay, I can't use the telephone, David, so take the email and don't complain. Since they were encouraged to use their arms, could they throw balls around with each other? Could they have a little basketball hoop in the room and shoot basketballs with these little mini Nerf balls and things like that? Could there be any sports activities using their arms?
How funny. Actually, exertion to that degree would probably be frowned upon. To tell you the truth, I don't know. We never asked. Certainly, we would chuck things across the room toward the wastebasket. And, we threw a couple of inflatable things around between beds a couple of times.
Like beach balls or something like that.
Sure, yeah. And we got up to mischief. One time we took the CPR dummy and put a toe tag on it and then wheeled ourselves back up the hall. So, you know, so there's certainly room for shenanigans, although I probably shouldn't say that. As long as you follow the protocols, there's certainly nothing against having fun. I don't know if they'd let you throw a ball with any strenuous.
Like a Nerf football, you know, if you were in a room with someone else, play catch with a Nerf ball or something like they're lightweight.
Yeah, well, it'd be something you'd have to ask the nurses. I don't think they'd say no, but I don't know.
So you didn't see it happening, though?
Huh?
You didn't see anyone engaging in any kind of sports like that in any way whatsoever?
No, uh-uh. No, we would go outside, and you can roll, but that's about it. You are pretty limited when you're in bed.
And you did nothing in water, correct?
We did no water immersion. No, to my knowledge, they've not done any water immersion studies there. At least not that I saw.
Do you come away with this thinking And I know you do because you're committed to space, but the other people do they think they've really helped make a difference to further human space flight, as well as to help with Earth medical issues and making life better for people here on Earth? Do they come away with a solid feeling that they've accomplished this?
Absolutely. I've never met anybody in the programs or, you know, helped anybody get through screening who contacted me who wasn't absolutely proud and competitive. And I've had people, you know, come home from round one of screening, email me back and say, okay, I did it. Here's what they said. What do you think my chances are? And they're, you know, fingers crossed, desperately hoping that they get in. And when people are done, there's a real feeling of accomplishment, especially if you get the idea that they've gotten good data from you and that you followed all the protocols. And it's, yeah, it becomes a contest of sorts, you know. Hey, did you throw up during the tilt test? No. Did you throw up during the tilt test? It becomes a real, you know, because you talk a lot. You're there all day with each other, all day, every day. Everybody really had the sense that, yeah, you're doing something for science. You're doing something for space that's going to have a huge payoff for not just you, for humanity. And that when that first person, whoever it is, I hope they've already been born, sets a human foot on Mars, that each and every one of us will be able to say, I was a part of that. I was a small part of that.
Well, you're pretty young. Maybe you'll be one of those who goes to Mars.
Oh, I hope so. If they solve the propulsion and the radiation, you betcha. I'd go one way. I'm one of the one-way trippers.
Was anything about space tourism, did that ever come up, or like the suborbital 5 or 6 minute flights? Of microgravity. Did anything like that come up in the studies?
Not really. I mean, I know those exist, and I know a lot of people who have done parabola flights. I suppose if I had nothing but cash lying around, I'd probably go do it. But I haven't. I've never skydived either, so I better get it in gear here, I suppose.
Have you scuba dived?
I've never scuba dived, no. I guess I do have survival instincts somewhere in there that keep me from doing all these things where you could die easily.
Well, yeah, you're so surrounded by doctors and people there, I don't think you're going to die very easily down in Galveston.
But maybe that's why I was so healthy. I've never done anything totally dangerous to my health. But no, there's one part of me that says I'd really love to just enjoy my middle age in peace now. But if trips to Mars really did become commonplace and it was still in my lifetime, I'm pretty sure I'd take them up on it.
Okay, final question, unless you think of something else.
Okay.
Family and friends, did they think you were a total whack job, or were they extremely supportive, or did they have to be convinced?
A little bit of a cross-section. I actually flew home before I did this to talk to some people and to just kind of disclose what I was doing, because, of course, they ask you for an emergency contact if anything happens to you. I had a couple of people think that I was just really off my nut, but I had a couple of people who said, this is amazing, you know, go for it, I hope you get in, and so that gave me some confidence, and when I did get in, I had a little bit of a, you know, time to think about it, because you've got to, it's a trick, being away from home. Even for 14 days, never mind 100.
No, I know. I mean, it can be a burden. So
you have to recruit your family. Even if they think you're nuts, you have to recruit them a little bit. You
know. Okay, so not to pry into your personal life at all, so you can answer this generically. For people that are married or have significant relationships, how important is it that their partner or spouse be extremely supportive of this, or do you find people doing it despite the fact that their husband or wife says, I don't want you to be gone for 100 days, or their significant other says, but I won't see you for 100 days. You can't do this.
Yeah.
So do you have to bring along the person? Do they have a program to help do that?
Sure. They have part of the orientation binder material is also how to talk to your family, how to talk to your kids, how to talk to your spouse, what they can and cannot send you. What they can and cannot do when they come visit. There's a whole, write-up on that. I would think that's very important. They did ask me about that in the psychological screening. They asked me, about my parents and my siblings. They asked me about my boyfriend at the time and what he thought and how I felt about it. So, yeah, that's a big part of it, because if you're missing someone or if you're worried about your child being in the care of someone else, I would think having an unwilling spouse would probably be pretty detrimental. I really didn't have to worry about much beyond my swimming pool pump, though. That was my only repair issue that I left in someone else's hands that I was curious about. I didn't have any people who said, no, I'm absolutely not going to help you. I suppose if I had kids, it would be a bigger worry.
Did you have a dog or a cat that you were worried about?
I did not. I did not have any animals at the time where I lived in north of Austin, Texas. It was just the house that needed to be secured and the pool that needed to be taken care of. The parents that I met there were both, two of the women had their husbands watching their children, and one of the men had a wife watching the child. And I think they were pretty well supported. I think they spoke to their significant others quite a bit on the phone. One of them had a habit of talking to her child every night before she went to bed, right before they take your cell phone. I should probably mention
that. Oh, they take your cell phone?
You have to give up your cell phone. It lights out.
Why?
Well, it's very important that you get the sleep. If you have any kind of sleep disorders or insomnia or sleepwalking or anything like that, you would probably not get in. Sleep is very important because you cannot sleep during the day. You've got to have good quality, natural, deep sleep.
And they don't want you taking sleeping pills or something like that?
No, absolutely not. Yeah, I think the most you could ever take is an aspirin, and then some of the women are supplemented with iron because, of course, during our menses we lose iron.
So I'm assuming you could, you know, Skype with your family and have video conferencing and all, if you had a laptop and a webcam. So you could do that all day, I guess, with
sure.
Family, friends. And so it's not like you're on the other side of the earth and no one's seeing or hearing from you.
No, not at all. You can talk on your phone whenever you want. And I mean, unless you're in an active test where they need you to be giving them your reactions back, you know. Can you breathe all right? Are you comfortable? Stuff like that.
I don't know if it sounds like fun or not, but it's definitely interesting.
One of the more unique things I've ever done, certainly. There's nothing else like it.
And you're still recruiting other people, right? You're not planning on doing it again. Is that correct?
I am still recruiting. No, I don't know if I would go back for another one. Right now, I don't think I can because it's all men in a certain study. But I know there's going to be a couple of developed this year where there will be screening both men and women again for different programs. But if I was still living in Texas, I might. But no, I go to a lot of different types of industry events and you've heard of NASA tweet-ups and NASA social.
Correct.
So I do a lot of networking and I bring literature with me wherever I go and try to educate people best I can about what the protocol is really like, because there's a lot of misinformation.
Well, you've certainly told us what it's really like, and as I said when I introduced you, we've had people on the show that talk about, oh, NASA does simulation of microgravity through bed rest studies, and if you're really interested, JSC has a website so you can go find out about it. That's about the extent of it.
Yeah.
So after nearly 12 years on the space show and coming up on 2,000 interviews, you're unique.
The first one to tell you what it's really like daily, huh?
Including the privacy issues. I mean, this is no holes barred here, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things that, you know, you need to know. You can certainly ask those questions during screening, and they'll answer you very candidly. But the scientists, of course, would probably be more interested in talking to you about the medical information and what they're looking for. I'm sorry, I'm not a better scientist. They could probably tell you much, much more about the medical side of it.
Fascinating. Any closing comments? Any words you'd like to leave with us?
No, other than if you think it sounds like something you might be tough enough to do and think you could get through it, please definitely do go to that website that you just said or come to my blog and read some of the daily stuff. There's lots of information there, both for men and women, and they're always looking for healthy, motivated people who are enthusiastic about space.
25 to 55, right?
25 to 55 non-smokers.
Non-smokers. Does that include dope?
That definitely includes dope. Yes, you will have a breathalyzer and a drug test as well.
Oh, really? You And I guess you can't do any wine or even a casual drink or anything when you're there, right?
No, no alcohol, no coffee, no soda. The very first thing I did when I got out of bed was I went to the Coke machine.
Not even a diet soda, nothing?
Nothing, no.
What about tea?
No tea.
Not even herbal tea?
Not even herbal tea.
Oh, my God. What do you drink, just water?
Milk, different kinds of juices, lots of water every day, yeah. You will certainly emerge probably healthier than you've ever been. Every time I've done a study, I've gotten off caffeine and felt fantastic. I wish I didn't always go back to it, but I can't seem to keep myself from drinking tea.
So this being the Bay Area in California, of course, medical marijuana would not cut it, right?
No, you wouldn't be able to. Well, any medicine, really. It wouldn't matter. You wouldn't be able to take any regular medication.
Very, very interesting. Heather, well, you have done great work, and you have contributed, and you certainly have contributed to our understanding of these protocols and this entire process. And I really thank you for sharing so much and telling us about it.
Oh, I'm so glad you're interested, and thank you so much for having me. You know, if you get a hold of Dwayne.
I will do so. I'm going to try. And you said you had a last website or something for him, right?
Yes, I have a collection of his articles that I'll email you.
Okay, and I've already emailed John and you the information on the nuclear rocket petition with WhiteHouse.gov, so you both should already have that.
Okay.
And I will check Dwayne with my friends who are lifetime members of the Aerospace Medical Association, and if I can put this together, I will get back in touch with you and let you know and would welcome you back to join with us.
All right, sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And listeners, that's it for our Tuesday Space Show. Tomorrow on the John Batchelor Show on our segment, former astronaut Ed Liu is the guest. We're talking about an approaching asteroid and the B612 Foundation, which Ed is now the one running B612. So he's going through a lot of changes over there at the Batchelor Show, and I don't really know how easy it is for you to hear it live anymore because a lot of the streaming sites have changed. But if you go to johnbatchelorshow.com, I think that's his website, you'll see he's got a New Jersey a Rhode Island website and a Wichita, Kansas website that's streaming. And our segment is 6:30 p.m. California time. So that's probably the best way to hear it, or you can hear it on archives on the Space Show if you're interested. And then Friday, our regular Space Show program, you don't want to miss that. Check it out in the newsletter, and the same for Sunday. So thank you all for tuning in tonight, and I hope everyone has a good bed rest tonight. And Heather, thanks again, and I look forward to talking to you again down the road.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Good night, everyone, on behalf of the Space Show and Heather.